hunting down Chicanos like the Terminator, hoping in vain that one day he may be able to wake up and scrub the brown out of downtown, or at the very least, out of his own skin. Downtown. Is drowned out by the boom, boom, boom of tricked out impalas and cherried out mini trucks as the cat calls of oppression are heard up and down Santa Clara Street. And beautiful Latinos strut by on 6 deep in midnight blue Buick Rivieras with gold smokes and silver crucifixes hanging from the rearview mirror. Downtown when you're brown on a Friday night, all the signs say no cruising zone, but what they really mean.
Welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris, and this is a two-hour show that starts at 6 and goes to 8 and concerns itself with local issues, predominantly civil rights issues, issues of war and peace, and issues also of poverty and homelessness, and what the rights are remaining that we have here and what we need to do to get together to restore rights we've lost and to reclaim rights we should have. Along those lines, of course, folks who've been following this show, and maybe some who haven't, know that on Tuesday, May 9th, item 17 on the Santa Cruz City Council's afternoon agenda will be the final reading of an ordinance regarding parking lots and garages. I call it the parking lot panic law. It makes it illegal to be in a parking lot at all unless you're walking through. You'll be subject to an infraction crime penalty, which means a fine of $100 and up. If you're parking your vehicle or bicycle, you'll be allowed in the parking lot or garage, but only for 15 minutes, reversing a traditional natural practice of allowing people to park in a parking lot in their vehicle, spend as much time they want or need in and around their vehicle, waiting for people, listening to music, working on homework, doing what they normally do. This will suddenly cut a huge chunk of space, 8 to 10 city blocks, out of the public spaces downtown. I'm not sure if it's because they want to crowd everybody into the cafes. Subconsciously, their conscious claim, the Public Works Department, which originated this law, is that they're trying to protect their parking workers from homeless campers. They're trying to protect cars from burglary, the parking lots from vandalism, unescorted or escorted women from harassing remarks, assaults, and so forth. And the problem, of course, with this entire scenario, and these kinds of protections are a good idea. Who wants their car vandalized? Who wants to be harassed? I don't know about the idea. I do know the idea about the campers and the homeless campers is certainly wrong-headed, because if you haven't got shelter space for people, the idea that you actually want to consciously make a law that will drive people out into the rain and forbid them to take any kind of even temporary shelter is kind of beyond the pale. I don't even imagine that even non-church-going secular humanists wouldn't want to do that. Decent people don't want to do that. But in fact, when you get into the bureaucracy of a city, you no longer have the element of decency vanishes the lower you go income-wise, and that seems to be what's happening here. Anyway, this law is coming up for a second reading at City Council. You can read the packet in the public library. That's where I just came from. There's not much of a packet. There's nothing new. It's exactly the same law. The only exceptions are if you're parking a vehicle, then you get 15 minutes. If you have a permit from the city, or if you're a city worker on city business, which is an interesting kind of special interest exemption there. It doesn't just say a parking lot worker. It says any city worker. So I guess join up to be a city worker, and once more you'll be able to restore your right to sit in your vehicle and listen to your radio or write a letter to a friend or check in on the Internet. But until then, you'll have lost that right on all public parking spaces downtown, other than, of course, street spaces. Parking lots and garages will be out of bounds for any kind of sitting in your car. Anyway, I think it's absurd. I think it's abusive. I think it has to do with the growing move to gentrify the downtown and criminalize poor people, particularly since the main crime category and the main scare tactic used by the SEIU representative, Leslie Scanagata, was homeless people and what they do, which has to do with, you know, homeless people are a group like any other group. They're varied in terms of how they treat other people. But the main thing they need that house people don't is, of course, a place for a shelter at night or when the elements are inclement, as they say. Anyway, you can join this discussion. You can comment on other issues around the downtown, around the rights of poor people, around issues of police abuse or excellence, if you will. You know, take some commendatory comments about police officers here, if you'd like. The phone number to call is 831-427-3772, 427-3772. You can also go to pagesincolor.com. That's where I am right now, all alone in the chat room. And I will keep an occasional eye on that chat room. And then you'll be able to go on the air and talk with the rest of us, talk with the community, and invite others to come back and talk back. And that's what this radio show is all about, and a lot of talk radio is about that, if we're not selling commercial products, which, of course, Free Radio Santa Cruz doesn't do. The new Street Spirit is in, for those who are interested in the homeless newspaper out of the American Friends Service Committee. Comes out of Oakland. It's a 16-pager with lots of poetry. Headline story, poor tenants deceived by Oakland housing. Official now faces nightmare of mass eviction. There's a long story on California's for-profit nursing homes. The drive for nursing home profits ensures poor care and continuing horror stories. There's a Berkeley story that, interestingly enough, I witnessed some stuff going on in Berkeley this afternoon when I was up there picking up these street spirits in San Francisco. I drove across the bay. Immoral and disgraceful attacks on the free box up at People's Park. That's the box that people donate clothing and other items that they wish to give away, and people pick up those items. The University of California apparently doesn't like that idea. According to Terry Messman, whose editorial I'm about to read, I think I'll read a little of his editorial. Imagine if the powers that be marched into every church, confiscated all the poor boxes, outlawed all the free clothing programs, and banned charitable meals. For many Berkeley residents, that is precisely what is at stake when University of California officials order UC police officers to swoop down on People's Park and demolish its free clothing program, the Free Box. The destruction of the Free Box in People's Park is an unconscionable act of vandalism by UC officials who have destroyed it five times in the last 4 months. UC officials, we're not talking about skateboarders or gangs or psychotics with axes or wild political activists. These are UC officials. That's my addition to the story. To add insult to injury, police seized and hauled away a newly built mobile Free Box on Monday, April 24th, the morning after the People's Park's anniversary was celebrated this year. The University of California's immoral and disgraceful war on the free box is considered to be an act of desecration by many People's Park supporters, on a par with police marauding through a church to destroy the poor boxes that collect charitable contributions for the poor. Why do Berkeley activists react so strongly when the free box is attacked? After all, it is merely a box built of wood, set up so people can donate surplus clothing to the poor, and there are admitted problems with the operation of the free box. Sometimes the, quote, wrong elements take the clothes to sell at used clothing stores or leave clothes scattered about. Yet instead of trying to solve these problems in a constructive way and thus preserve the people's ability to donate used clothing to poor people who badly need it, UC officials have repeatedly used the most crude and violent methods to destroy and outlaw the free box. These repeated acts of destruction by UC officials should indeed be considered acts of desecration on two levels. First, UC officials and police have attempted to demolish the act of giving itself, a sacred calling and moral obligation for many. Second, activists consider the assault on the free box to be an attack on the spirit of People's Park itself, an assault on the very values that gave birth to the park in 1969. In recent years, many free clothing programs have been shut down in Berkeley, most notably the free clothing store operated by the Berkeley Ecumenical Chaplaincy for the Homeless was closed due to lack of funding. As a result, homeless and poor people truly have a critical need for the free clothing they find at the free box. When the powers that be destroy the free box, they are simultaneously destroying the people's ability to give help in the form of warm, dry clothing to the poor. Since clothing is itself a life-sustaining necessity, especially for homeless people constantly exposed to the elements, it is almost impossible to overstate how cruelly inhumane the University of California's acts of desecration really are. Dorothy Day and Peter Morin, the founders of the Catholic Worker, reminded us that feeding the hungry, sheltering the homeless, and clothing the naked make up the works of mercy and are a sacred obligation. No official should ever attempt to ban the works of mercy. The constant attacks on the free box by UC officials and police are inhumane in any civilized society. And for people of faith who practice the works of mercy, the destruction of the free box is nothing less than sacrilege. One wonders how a UC official or a cop carrying out orders could ever sleep at night after attacking and outlawing the practice of compassion itself. Food Not Bombs members are concerned that UC officials may crack down on their meal program in People's Park. In an open letter to UC Regent Richard Bloom, activist Don McMillan wrote, UC police officers are stationed in People's Park to cite those that would have the audacity to donate clothes or food to Berkeley's homeless and working poor. The ceaseless attacks of UC officials also amount to a desecration of the values of peace, love, and justice that brought People's Park to birth. In an era when the average UC official or student may see People's Park as an unwanted anachronism, perhaps it's time to recall our history. Berkeley activists fought for decades to establish People's Park. Might be nice to have a People's Park down here, folks. And then preserve it as a haven for all the people. Every step of the way, they had to battle the maligned forces of the University of California and its heavily armed police. This was a political fight for the soul of Berkeley from the beginning. Far from being some innocuous bureaucracy merely trying to protect its real estate, the UC administration began carrying out reactionary political maneuvers back in 1967 when it used the power of eminent domain to take over land in the South Campus area zoned for residences. UC officials pretended they needed to demolish homes located there to create a soccer field. Instead, UC administrators left the land vacant for months, letting it become a parking lot and a dumping ground for trash, litter, and junk cars. Actually, I think they were doing it, my recollection is not for a soccer field, but for a dormitory. But they didn't do anything. They just left it vacant. This is in the late 60s. Since they left it vacant, why did they take it over the land in the first place? Fred Dutton, the UC regent who opposed the decision, said UC's land grab was a deliberate act against hippie culture. Robert Shearer wrote that UC officials were carrying out a strategy of eliminating the culture of protest by denying it its turf. UC officials refused the requests of area residents to build a park on the vacant lot and left it as a junked-out parking lot and eyesore. So it is the height of hypocrisy for UC officials to now pretend they have to tear down the free box because a few clothes are occasionally scattered about. The whole park was a dumping ground when UC officials controlled it. Finally, in April and May of 1969, activists mobilized and resisted the Berkeley police and then Governor Ronald Reagan's National Guard in order to liberate People's Park. Tens of thousands of people marched to the streets of Berkeley to protest the University of California's attempt to take back the park. More than 100 people were injured by police firing shotguns into the protesters, and James Rector was killed by police during the struggle for People's Park. Countless people gathered with shovels, hoes, and rakes to transform the empty parking lot into a park for the people. People's Park thus became one of the only spaces of land in the entire United States to be liberated from corporate control by the power of the people. It is of crucial importance today to understand the dedication of activists who fought for People's Park against that overwhelming police presence. For that same level of commitment to the park is the reason people were so outraged when UC police hauled away the Free Box once again last month. For many of its supporters, the Free Box is emblematic of a time when people gave a damn about social injustice and the ideals of brotherhood and sisterhood. People's Park lives as a concrete expression of the values of sharing, community, and freedom. A park liberated for use by the people is an alternative to a society dedicated to massive greed and the selfish pursuit of power. It keeps alive the rebellious spirit of the counterculture, when peace and love and justice were higher values than money and possessions and real estate. The works of mercy are feeding the hungry, sheltering the homeless, clothing the naked. That is what is at stake here. UC officials are trying to abolish the works of mercy. They must be resisted. The Kinks, one of the finest musical groups of all, once recreated themselves as the Village Green Preservation Society, dedicated to saving the beautiful emblems of a passing era from destruction. The most important thing to be saved was, of course, the Village Green itself, the commons belonging to all people. What is at stake in the struggle over the Free Box is the very soul of People's Park and the very concept of the Village Green. The Kinks released the Village Green Preservation Society just as the struggle for People's Park was heating up. Their anthem concludes with a passionate prayer that is just as meaningful today, "God save the Village Green." Preserve the Free Box, if only as a way to declare that the money economy won't have the last word in our society. Preserve People's Park, if only to tell the soulless bureaucrats that they can't remake us all in the image of selfish corporate greed. God save the Village Green. That is immoral and disgraceful attacks on the Free Box, an editorial in this month's Street Spirit Monthly homeless newspaper by Terry Messman, editor and activist. You know, I feel the same way about what's happening here in the parking lots and garages. I mean, they're obviously not parks in the same sense. They don't have the same, obviously, comfortable scene where one can go and relax. But they do represent hundreds of small parking spaces where people are able to have a little bit of liberty in their vehicle, if they have a vehicle. And other people are able to go up, talk to them, walk through, gather, meet, do what they would do in any other public space in town without being told that that's private property, they have to buy a cup of coffee to be there, that there's a closing hour, they can't be there because it's after such and such an hour, as, for example, has happened with all the city parks and the riverbanks. So it's really a part of the right of all of us to have a little space in which to be ourselves. And not to have to look over our shoulder to wonder if a police officer is coming or a city bureaucrat is coming. And not to feel that we're surrounded with fences wherever we go. That all this is fenced off from us, if not by actual literal fences, by the fences of the threat of police action or criminal action and fines and so forth. So that's the reason I encourage everyone out there to oppose the parking lot trespass law, even after it perhaps inevitably passes on Tuesday night. Interestingly enough, I saw one letter. One new letter was in the packet in the library. The ACLU's statement against this law, it came out against the law. At least it said it didn't favor putting the parking lots in the garages. It might favor parking garages, though there were problems with that part of it too. And probably I'll be reading that on Sunday when I come back. There's a long show on Sunday morning, for those who don't know, from 9:30 to 1 in the afternoon. There was only one letter, and that letter was by actually a member of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a homeless man, Glenn, who is going to try to get the city council to separate the parking lots from their law to make it only apply to the parking garages. Other HUF members, the majority, felt that it was not a good idea to accept any part of this law. But Glenn pointed out that there's a a real need, for example, to have homeless people gather at the parking lot across from Elm Street Mission on Elm Street, which is a city parking lot, and which would also be illegal with a month after this law has its second reading and is passed by the council. It's due to have its second reading in the afternoon of May 9th, Tuesday, at the Santa Cruz City Council. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of input from the community, at least none that is visible. And when, as I've said before, that there doesn't seem to be any attempt to change this law to even respect the needs of disabled people, to pay some attention to the, some people have cited the Jones versus L.A. case, which is, we've talked about on the air here too, for those who've heard this show before, decision in Los Angeles that making it illegal for people to sleep at night is criminal behavior, is not acceptable behavior by the city, is forbidden behavior, unless they have a shelter to offer someone. You can't simply criminalize the status of being homeless and say, if you fall asleep, you're therefore a criminal, we can arrest you for that. And they did that within a limited zone, the Skid Row zone in L.A., and that decision has not yet been picked up here in Santa Cruz by our officials or by our civil libertarians or indeed by our homeless advocates by filing for an injunction, which is what the homeless did in Los Angeles and what they're doing also in San Diego, by the way. However, it does, it is the ruling precedent now in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a huge federal judicial district that covers about, six, seven states of the West, includes all of California. So, in theory, if we were able to get together the money and have the legal support to try to get an injunction, we would be able to get an injunction if the district judge followed the federal law, or I should say the federal decision by the 2-to-1 majority of the judges, that said arresting homeless people for sleeping when they have no place to sleep is cruel and unusual punishment and violates the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits imposing cruel and unusual punishments. And it's a complicated matter, an expensive matter from one perspective, because you need to get attorneys who are willing to donate a lot of time, or pay off attorneys, which is even more expensive, and then you need to get a lot of money to pay for all the depositions and declarations and legal fees, which amounts to thousands and thousands of dollars. But there's another way to proceed too, or to begin to work toward this, and that is to establish a clear record that the police in Santa Cruz are arresting people and yet have no shelter for them. And the one way to do that is to start doing one of those old-time sleepouts that perhaps some of my listeners here are familiar with, some of you out there not remember, downtown in a very visible, well-lighted place. And to only just go to sleep at 11 o'clock at night when the police come to say, look, give us another place to sleep and that's fine. Otherwise, cite me. And if you do, you'll be violating federal law as it's been interpreted in the Ninth District Court of Appeals and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And if the police do ticket us or arrest us, you'd have to be actually a person who really is homeless, although the rest of us could sleep out in solidarity and get tickets anyway, or stay awake and provide, tell amusing bedtime stories or sing gentle lullabies or just be around. It's not illegal to be up late at night in Santa Cruz yet. They're going to make it illegal to be in the parking lots and garages, but it won't be illegal to be outside. So sleepouts downtown are a way of establishing very clearly that the city is violating the Constitution of the United States, the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. And that may then become a very clear basis for some attorneys who want to make a little money to step in and say, okay, you've got it all documented, we'll pick it up from here. And that's what I'm talking about with other homeless activists at the Huff meetings. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet every Wednesday between 9:30 and 11:30 in the morning. It's at the courthouse right near the coffee cart as you come into the entrance of the courthouse in the atrium area between the courthouse and the county building. And everybody's welcome. Buy a coffee if you can't afford it. Human Rights Organization also meets, and that's actually a meeting sooner. They meet every Saturday at 1:45 out at 115 Coral Street, the Homeless Service Center, in the dining bay, 1:45 Saturday afternoon. They're doing some scheming and plotting, too, around this and other issues. And there's going to be a demonstration coming up on Saturday downtown at 3 o'clock. And I'll be talking about that after this this next song.
Reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. That seed will grow warmed by the sun. So plant a seed, reach out to one. Reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. So reach out to one and plant a seed. In this busy world, folks don't take time to learn the truth, and they rely on what they hear on primetime news and right-wing pundits paid for views. Although the truth is hard to bear, the seeds of peace are everywhere. And when these seeds begin to flower, we'll see that people have the power. Reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. That seed will grow warmed by the sun. So plant a seed, reach out to one. Reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. So reach out to one and plant a seed.
The seed of change can be so small you might not know it's there at all. But seasons turn and it may sprout, then soon its seeds will spread about. If we will just reach out each day, the truth will bloom like a bouquet. Then all their lies will be exposed and this whole world will be transposed.
Reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. That seed will grow warmed by the sun. So plant a seed, reach out to one, reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. So reach out to one and plant a seed.
We must know what we speak about. It doesn't help to swear and shout. Facts must be known before they're spread like seeds upon a flower bed. And if we listen, we may hear what lies behind their doubt and fear. With kindness we can till the ground and plant the seeds. Peace will abound.
Reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. That seed will grow warmed by the sun. So plant a seed. Reach out to one. Reach out to one and plant a seed. One little seed is all you need. So reach out to one and plant a seed.
And that's Annie and the Vets singing Peace to Power. You're tuned to Free Radio. It's 101.1 FM or freakradio.org, depending whether you're listening to the broadcast or the stream, or both for the real fans. I'm Robert Norris. Call-in number here is 427-3772, talking about the parking lot panic law and some other nasty practices. Just read an editorial by Terry Messman from about the Berkeley, UC Berkeley police attack on People's Park's free box. And, of course, what we have down here is an attack on the, actually not just on the homeless, but an attack on the entire community, a seizure of public space, allegedly, again, in the interest of, like, not national security, mind you, but local security. I mean, it's this, the terrorist threat, the threat of crime and fear and drugs and the homeless. And instead of looking at the problem in a sort of dispassionate way and saying, what's really the best response to this, we have a tailor-made response that's being shoved through by Councilmember Ryan Coonerty and his allies on the City Council and by cooperative minions on the Downtown Commission, who actually, they did take the stand that said they weren't going to do anything immediate, but they were going to examine it But then when they had gotten inadequate documentation from the police department that indicated no crime wave downtown, no specific crime wave in the parking garages, not much in the way of meaningful figures at all for parking lots, though they did, finally the police did cough up some figures about four lots. And then some anecdotal incidents by parking lot attendants or parking lot workers about the problems they were having. And you can get all this. It's not posted on the Internet. It's not posted on the city's website. It is available in the library. And I'm trying to think if it was I'm going to try to get someone to scan it in to the indiebay.org/Santa Cruz website. That's the Indie Media, our local Indie Media, which, while it may have its problems by censoring people like Becky Johnson, which is regrettable, it also serves as a medium where we can also discuss issues. Becky Johnson is my producer and writes on homeless matters, and I'm continuing to lobby Indie Bay, Indie Media, to stop doing this on homeless issues. I think it's really counterproductive, and I would encourage other people to do the same, to make that same lobbying effort, because we need to have as inclusive a media service as possible. But again, the broader issue here is, what do we do, first of all, what's going to be happening in the around this parking lot panic law? There's going to be a protest or a sort of a little event that will be happening on Saturday. Here's a flyer that describes it. I'll read a bit of it, and it should be posted soon, again, on this website, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, which is Santa Cruz Indie Media. Celebrating the expected May 9th passage of Bookshop Santa Cruz and Councilmember Ryan Coonerty's downtown parking lot panic law. This is going to be an event that will happen 3 p.m. on Saturday in front of Artisans at approximately Church and Pacific Streets downtown in Santa Cruz. And let's see what this caller has to say, and then I'll continue with this flyer. Hey, caller, you're on free radio. Hello?
Hey, Becky Johnson is not blocked from publishing.
Sorry, speak up. Hello? Yeah, I'm having trouble hearing you. Okay, try again, caller. All I heard was the words Becky Johnson did not, and then that was all I could hear. But feel free to call in. I'm not really inviting a big debate on this. I'm willing to talk about this issue. I continue to lobby for it and will continue to mention it as long as it is the case. As long as I see posts that are not hidden but that in fact are removed, that I knew were put up there, that are neutral as far as issues that Indie Media is sensitive on, like Israeli issues, but that have nothing to do with that, but have to do with the homeless. When I see those issues are not allowed full coverage by people, even that Indie Bay doesn't like, I'm going to mention it, and I'm going to encourage people to encourage Indie Bay to stop doing that. It's just not productive on homeless issues to do that. Now, you may disagree with me, caller, because I suspect you probably do, but hey, that's what it's about. We have a right to disagree. And again, let me get back to this downtown parking lot panic law, which is going to be the subject of some debate and discussion and hopefully some satire. The Huff has put together a special downtown discipline division, which pretty much consists of the regular activists, who will be having a special training exercise to aid the unwashed and the unruly on Saturday at 3 p.m. in front of Artisans at Pacific and Church Street, as I was talking about before. What are we going to be doing? Well, there's some on the agenda are learning the new rules for parking lots and garages. This will be a special briefing session inviting homeless and housed people to learn how to train to avoid being arrested in a parking lot or garage after June 9th or June 8th, when this law goes into effect, if it's passed on May 9th at the next city council meeting, where you are going to have some umbrellas and some chairs, maybe a little, and teach people how to stand under the overhangs of shops, particularly the shops of the merchants who really favor this law. They want to remove the public space for people to get shelter from the rain, let's say, or to come in out of the wind. So I would think that reasonably, it's really not unnatural to expect these shops to find some way to give back what they're taking away from the city. And that's going to be, we're going to help to train people on how to do this in a civil and a courteous and a friendly way, to have, kind of people cluster at these shops and also give them the credit that they so richly deserve for, in fact, passing this law or putting pressure on the Downtown Association to endorse this law, the Downtown Commission to push this law forward, and the City Council to pass the law. And Artisans is one business that did this. And there are other businesses downtown, like the Bookshop Santa Cruz, which I assume also favors this law. I say I assume it because Ryan Coonerty is a part of that management. He's been the lead figure. Now, I could be wrong. If these stores wish to disassociate themselves from this law and suggest that a more humane approach is necessary and that space should not be stolen from the community and particularly from poor and homeless people until it is replaced, until alternate space is available, or until there's other solutions have been honestly and thoughtfully considered in public meetings, then, you know, we can perhaps suggest other areas for people to go for the for a parking lot overflow training area. But until that happens, I think we have to really hold those accountable who are pushing this stuff. So I think it's a good idea. And we'll be down there with some, perhaps a little food, certainly some petitions, some tables, some flyers. And we invite you to bring a chair, an umbrella, or a parasol, if you will, since it's probably not going to rain on Saturday, but to train people into how to use the areas on Pacific Avenue as a substitute for the areas being taken by a law that is essentially being endorsed by the merchant community, or at least the Downtown Association, insofar as that is a representative of the merchant community. So that's going to be one thing we're going to be doing. You're going to learn how to shelter yourself. You can use the convenient parking lot overflow zones on Pacific Avenue. Learn how to shelter yourself under the eaves and overhangs on Pacific Avenue against the elements while not blocking shoppers' view of merchandise and store windows. Learning to use the kazoo, for example, while panhandling to encourage financial support. And you can also learn some other tips, like how to enforce this law as it, when it comes into effect in June against scofflaw shoppers and intransigent rascally tourists. You can spot a motorist or biker using a parking lot for more than 15 minutes and then document this criminal behavior. You know, you can use a video camera to capture the offending motorist's license plate number. Then you can make a citizen's arrest or demand that the police do this. After all, this is a violation of the law. And you can teach also, you can also encourage the tourists who come into town and residents who park there to park fast and get out to avoid the criminal penalties of this law. Kind of rapid exit techniques. We'll be teaching those techniques as well. Then we're also going to be working on the issue of sleeping within the law at this seminar, 3 p.m. on Saturday in front of Artisans, which is downtown. It's near Gelato Mania, kind of across from the Rittenhouse fenced-off area, one of the few undeveloped areas in the downtown area. Sleeping within the law, the new Jones et al. Versus L.A. court decision documenting illegal police wake-up calls of the homeless when the emergency shelter program is full. I've kind of talked about this a little bit before. We'll be discussing suggestions for setting up a tent city to ensure homeless protection against local trollbusters. We'll create a lobby while you sleepwalk scenario for educating the city council. And again, we're going to be trying to sign up people, supporters, for an injunction against the sleeping ban based upon this new court decision in Los Angeles that came out on April 14th. Other things are going to be happening. We're going to be doing some education, kind of a discussion of who's stealing public space again, peekaboo, who's behind the 15-minute fascist foolishness, as we call it, and why. Compiling information so local people can shop progressively. Which particular businesses are really responsible for that, and does the community want to patronize those businesses, given the kind of pressure they're putting on the city council to criminalize poor people downtown? This was an issue back in 1994 when Neil Coonerty, Ryan Coonerty's father and now a supervisorial candidate, led a campaign as a city council member to establish what are now the downtown ordinances, the laws that make it illegal to sit down most everywhere downtown. Not everywhere, but most everywhere. You have to be 14 feet from a building. You have to be 50 feet from a change-making machine. You have to be, I think it's, is it 10 feet or 14 feet from the corners? It leaves a very limited, essentially moves people to the curb. It also impacts musicians who are playing. So musicians have to essentially play at the curb, which has been pointed out years ago, is actually a way of making it more difficult for merchants because they have to play facing the shops instead of facing out from the shops. And the voluntary street performers guidelines were jettisoned by the city council in some years later, although they were maintained in fragments after the 1994 ordinances passed. By essentially, the 94 ordinances were not that strictly enforced against musicians. Originally, the 94 ordinances said you couldn't sit within 6 feet of a building. Originally, they said you couldn't sit at all. We had massive demonstrations against that. Police rioted, broke the ribs of one person, caused a pregnant woman to miscarry. Mayor Kennedy had no problems at all with what the police force did at the time when he was there. I remember sitting in the same room with him and trying to hold him accountable. He was not interested. Instead, of course, and the courts actually threw out the original sitting ban way back in 1994. Council passed another one that was said 6 feet. 2002, council expanded it to 14 feet, which means literally you can't sit down or set up a political table on any other sidewalk than Pacific Avenue, since only Pacific Avenue sidewalks are broader than 10 feet. You can't set up a table within 10 feet of a storefront. That's another rule that was expanded by this mostly current city council. Anyway, so we're talking about essentially trying to take back public space, trying to educate people, trying to reach out to each other to see if, you know, what kind of resources we have to do this, and to do so in a somewhat humorous vein. I mean, it's really important to show other people coming to Santa Cruz the absurdity of what the city is doing. And as has been said by some, a little laughter can go a long way. We're also going to be plotting, petitioning, and partying, signing up to legally support court challenges, initiatives, and direct action protests. And there's going to be... we're going to examine how to adopt a potential, some other sort of colorful strategies for dealing with the parking lot. Some suggestions are a parking lot scavenger hunt. There are going to be other events that will be discussed. And it's going to be an educational session. If you want to sign up to oppose the parking lot panic law, as I call it, and you haven't already done so, you'll be able to find a petition down there. And that will be, again, at 3 o'clock on Saturday, downtown on Pacific Avenue near Church Street, which is close to the Cinema 9 Theater on the other side of the street in front of Artisans. So that's happening, and now a little of this.
Came to town when I was 9 or 10. That day I learned a lesson I don't need to learn again. With a poster of a woman wearing nothing but a snake and 10 cents in my pocket, I was right for the take. She loved Fight the Snake. All it costs is one thin dime. See, she loved Fight the Snake. I think it might bite her this time. See, she loved Fight the Snake. Give me your dime. Then get in line.
I went into the tent. I could not my eyes. In the center of the room was a cage full of lies. Sheila was a rabbit with a sleepy gopher snake. You might call it truth, I call it fate.
See, Sheila fight the snake. All it costs is one thin dime. Fight the snake. I think it might bite her this time. See, Sheila, fight the snake. Give me your dime. Then get in line.
$300 billion is a whole lot of dimes. It's like walking in that tent again, just like old times. Time there's no Sheila. This time there's more at stake. The devil took your ticket. You've been bit by the snake.
See Sheila fight the snake.
All it costs is one thin dime. See Sheila fight the snake. I think it might bite her this time. See Sheila fight the snake. Give me your dime. Then get in line.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, I think you'll try it too. This time I'm gonna be ready. This time I'm gonna save my dime. For I have seen Sheila. I have seen the snake. And only a chump would put up with that double talking fake.
See Sheila fight the snake. All it costs is one thin dime. See Sheila fight the snake. I think it might bite her this time. See Sheila fight the snake. Give me your dime. Then get in line. See Sheila fight the snake. See Sheila fight the snake. See Sheila.
And we have a caller. Nice timing. Hey there, caller. You're on free radio.
Dead air.
Hello?
Hello. I don't hear anything on my radio.
You don't?
I don't hear anything at all.
Oh, dear.
Well, I'm going to try again.
Try again.
Oh, this... I hear you now.
Oh, good. All right, then. Thank you.
Yay.
Any other reports? Okay. That was my producer, Becky Johnson. So, your opportunity to call in, 427-3772. What I'm going to do now is complete something I wanted to do for a while, which is to play the last part of the Downtown Commission's discussion of the 15-minute trespass law, though then it was called the 10-minute trespass law. This happened on March 23rd. It was one of the two special meetings that were rushed forward under pressure from Ryan Coonerty and Cynthia Matthews, Mayor Matthews, to get the law on the city council agenda and pass it. The Downtown Commission is the advisory body that originally the city council was going to bypass completely, but some of us raised a stink about that, so they sent it to the Downtown Commission in January, removing it from the January City Council agenda. The Downtown Commission examined it in March in special meetings, a week apart, unprecedentedly close together, multiple meetings, which on one special topic, this particular topic, which I'm told by the Downtown Commission staff person is unprecedented, hasn't happened before. I played on free radio several of the previous March 16th meeting, and it's in a number of parts. If you want to find it, you can go to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, click under the name of the show, Bathrob Spears Broadsides, and then go to the show descriptions, and you'll find, if you kind of read through the show descriptions of the last month or two, you'll find a Downtown Commission hearing, and you'll be able to review it if you want to. I'm going to play this because it shows you the it's an unfortunate situation ultimately because the Downtown Commission surrendered. They did not stand up against the pressure from City Council and say, look, we need to examine this further. We haven't got enough information. Instead, they passed it on, you know, with reservations, which, of course, means that the City Council is going to do a slam dunk on it. At least that was my take and is still my take. So at any time you listeners out there want to call in with your comments or thoughts or questions, because I'm going to be interrupting this Downtown Commission discussion with my own comments, please feel free to do so. And again, the phone number is 427-3772. Again, hopefully I will have this. We'll have the staff reports available at the Saturday demonstration at 3 o'clock in front of Artisans Day after tomorrow downtown on Pacific Avenue if you want to come down. If you got a chair and an umbrella, bring it along. If you just want to check it out, please come down and check it out. There'll be petitions to sign and so forth, and it'll go from 3 to 5. At 4, we're probably going to move to the Bookshop Santa Cruz area because, that's the second business that we've decided might be an appropriate place for the parking lot panic trespass overflow training area where we're going to train people into how to follow the law. It's sort of like we were earlier training people how to deal with a sleeping band, how to sleepwalk all night and so forth, which is really, it's an important kind of training that people have to undergo in Santa Cruz, kind of unique perhaps, but important for those who want to be law abiding. So here now again is the Downtown Commission, the second part of the Downtown Commission. And previously there was a lot of testimony from Deputy Chief Kevin Vogel. And Kevin's testimony, as I said, is archived on the Huff website. He talks about how, in essence, there are, I think it's one or two police patrols a day there, and that there wouldn't be any additional expense for this. I didn't quite see how that would be the case, but he said no additional expense if this new law passes, even though it would mean that one could, there could be many more calls for service, because if somebody sees a person in the parking lot or garage and wants to call the cops on that person, that's a new crime, and therefore presumably requires additional police resources, even if the person is doing absolutely nothing. So let's hear some of the Downtown Commission discussion.
There's been a lot of talk about this 10-minute thing, but the first part of it says that they're just supposed to be used for people parking their cars and retrieving their cars.
And this is a member of the Downtown Commission asking a question. I think are the police officers there, the deputy chief, or Matt Farrell, who's the public works parking person, who's actually kind of the, if you will, evil genius behind this law. Before I go on here, we have a caller. Hi, caller. You're on free radio.
Off air?
You're on air.
Oh, I wanted to be off air.
Okay, well, let me catch you in a moment then. Stay there. So we're going to proceed with this, and I will have a secret conference with, let's see what the person wants.
So would that be another tool you could use if somebody's just hanging out? Could you say, well, where's your car, and cite them if they don't have their car or bicycle there?
I don't know what the exact text of the ordinance is right now. I think the intent of it is for people just not to be in the garage for 10 minutes, because the garages are for the specific purpose of parking cars or bicycles. I suppose that would be some part of the investigation process when we're asking questions as to where their car is, if they have a car. But John might be in a better position to answer that.
The ordinance specifically says any person who uses a City of Santa Cruz parking lot or garage for purposes other than motor vehicle or bicycle parking or retrieval in violation. So if a person's in there and they don't have a car in the parking lot and they're using the parking lot for some other purpose, that is a violation of the ordinance.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
We have Jerry. And then Joe.
In the interest of getting this to some kind of conclusion today. That clock is slow. We have less than an hour. We have a tremendous amount of input from the public. We've had numerous questions answered by staff. We have piles of notes and papers here. I would really like us to try in the next few minutes to bring this down to the commission level, just discussing among ourselves, trying to come up with...
This is Jerry Mandel, who favors the law.
...the motion...
On the downtown commission.
...discussing the motion and finalizing it so that we have something at the end of this meeting to turn into the city council.
Okay, Joe. Let's go ahead and ask additional questions of staff or members of the public, and then move into starting to think about a motion.
It just occurred to me that we have a private parking lot downtown behind Trader Joe's.
This is Joe of Atlantis Fantasy World on the Downtown Commission.
Yes, that's not a city-run lot, is that correct? So I have a question about what kind of activity is happening there. If there's is the police department responding to calls at that private lot? Do they have private security to take care of problems in their lot? I know the city of San Jose builds the parking lots, but then they don't operate them. They lease them out to private individuals, so there's not really a public lot. It's all private, and they can then have their own security to police those. But what kind of activity is happening at that parking lot behind Trader Joe's? Do you guys respond to those? What's the situation there?
They do have private security in the parking lot there behind Trader Joe's. The majority of the crews over there, they tow cars out of there like crazy, which we don't respond to. That's all handled by their private security people. Most of the calls that we get at Trader Joe's and Long's are actually at the stores themselves, and they involve shoplifting. We get very few problems relating to that parking lot that are reported to us.
Could I assume that's probably because if they see any kind of a problem, they have a private force they'll just ask those people to leave because it's private property and they can see you're trespassing, so move on?
Yeah, and if they don't gain cooperation, they can certainly call us. But I think the presence of a uniform makes a big difference in that particular parking lot. And, you know, believe it or not, a lot of people don't distinguish whether a uniform is a police officer, a security guard, a sheriff's deputy, they just see the uniform. So I think that's a big deterrent to that type of activity.
So the paid presence of a security officer there is deterring a lot of that activity?
Oh, without a doubt.
Without a doubt? I don't know. I mean, what's the is he examined? Is there a rise in criminal activity in other parking lots elsewhere in town where there are no paid security guards? Has that stat been established? Not that I know of. It wasn't brought forward. And indeed, Deputy Chief Vogel may have that stat and be relying on that stat. One would think, however, he would have had reference to it. And also, obviously, the second answer, there are two answers to this question. Well, you know, why are you having a lower crime rate? You know, or why are there no problems? Are there not many problems in the private parking lots? The answer might be, well, there aren't that many problems in the public parking lots either. Or what's the difference in the number of problems in public versus private parking lots? That hasn't been established. Another thing to consider was brought up in the last week by someone, I don't remember who, to me, is that once the city makes this decision to make it a 15-minute law, why wouldn't private businesses feel encouraged to do the same thing and tell people that they can't stay in their cars? And it become a more kind of sweeping sort of phenomenon, with the government taking the lead and essentially destroying the private space inside one's car, destroying what one thought was public space for one to have some private space in one's car. Why wouldn't private employers follow this lead?
Thank you.
Okay. I have one small question.
Sheila, and then I have...
I don't know if Matt answers this or he'd answer this. This ordinance, if you're in your car, if you drive your car into the garage and you sit in it over 10 minutes, are you liable to be cited? Or is it after you get out of your car?
Probably the city attorney.
The way the ordinance is written, if you're in the garage for over 10 minutes, whether you're in your car or outside the car, okay. It's a violation.
Okay, thank you. One more question for John. John, you were able to surface one other ordinance from Santa Barbara. That ordinance, as written, simply defines the purpose and use of the garages. It does not have a time limit on.
Right.
Do you have any idea how that's enforced and how that ordinance is working to solve any public safety
issues? No, it's been on their books for quite a while. I thought it was somewhat vague because it just uses the word remain, and you know, at what point is a person remaining on the lot and not, you know, parking or retrieving his vehicle, and that's why I recommended that we have a specific time period, and that's suggested 10 minutes.
Thank you. One more question for Matt regarding signage, which is going to be critical if this ordinance is passed. How do you sign something like this to a tourist that's coming into town for the first time and driving into the garage? Do you replicate the ordinance on a sign? What would that look like?
I don't think we would post language in the lots outlining the ordinance.
Yes, you would.
Because what we've talked about in terms of discussion about how this ordinance is going to be enforced, it's going to be enforced largely through a contact either with... monitor the use of the lot. If you look at the incidents reports that we've given to you, there are incidents of people staying in cars and garages, and we need a tool when those people are in their cars in their garage to tell people that they need to get out of their car in 10 minutes or leave the garage.
Why? Why do we need such a tool in terms of ordinary innocent behavior? And how much innocent behavior is this going to impact? I keep asking this question, but no member of the commission apparently asked it.
Because what those people are doing is probably getting ready to do something that we don't want them to do in that garage. You know?
So here's the assumption that people waiting in a vehicle in a parking lot are probably waiting to do something illegal. In the studio with me, I have... legal worker Ray Glock-Grunijk, who has been known to plot all kinds of things from his vehicle when he is fortunate enough to have one. I don't know if he has a driver's license or not. In the old days, did you have a driver's license, Ray?
I have had some driver's licenses in my life, yes.
And vehicles.
And vehicles, and even have some now. And one of them working.
I know in the past you've been in the studio talking about legal issues around the Jones case, the homeless case in L.A. that I mentioned earlier in the show, as well as all kinds of other things, and you're working on something else as we sit here. But what about the idea that it's good to give the police a tool, as Matt Farrell has just said, because people in a parking lot or garage seated in a car might be planning something illegal or probably are probably likely planning something illegal. So why not just tell them to leave, and doesn't that kind of solve the problem?
Well, actually, it goes to sort of an absurd degree. I mean, all people have potential of becoming criminals, so we should obviously do all kinds of awful things to infants as they're born, because they could become criminals if we don't. I'm just not impressed with the idea that somebody in a parking garage who's in a car is supposed to be viewed as a potential criminal or suspect. But that's the kind of mentality that I suppose our modern society, our post-9/11 society, is supposed to be cultivating. Viewing people always as what the threat is instead of just out there living life.
Well, it's been pointed out that, and the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women has pointed out there's been an upsurge of rape in, not in parking lots and garages specifically, as far as I know, but in, you know, in Santa Cruz City compared with other cities of its size, a very significant rise. And this was in the paper, I think, a week or two ago. Becky Johnson's talked about it on the air a little bit. And there was, of course, a whole exhibit done at City Hall last Friday.
And KUSP also had a program on it on Talk of the Bay. They had Mayor Cynthia Matthews and a representative from the police department and a representative of the, Julian Greensight of the Commission for Prevention of Violence Against Women, mm-hmm. I give a half hour or an hour program on that very same topic.
Well, we have some people that I disagree with, but I have respect for on other issues, like Ann Simonton, who's a free radio broadcaster and who's an activist on a number of issues of women's safety, who really strongly feels that this is a good law, as I understand her position, and that what are you going to do to protect, to protect the safety of women in these dark garages or in parking lots at night or even on the day when it's a cold, windy day when there's no one around? Isn't it better just to have a law that excludes everybody but people legitimately going to a vehicle, using their vehicle, parking it, and leaving? Santa Barbara does it. What's wrong with that?
At any rate, I'm opposed to the ordinance. I can think of all kinds of... I have a lot of respect for Anne, but if that's her position, I disagree with her on this one.
Well, what would you say to that position? I'm not trying to get personal. I mention Anne because she's a person of,
worthy respect, and you've got to call her.
Yeah, we've got to call her. You can just slip out of this because I got to call her here, Ray? It sounds like you are.
So.
Okay. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Ray and Robert.
Hey, Robert, this is Crow again. Once again, calling from an obnoxious payphone.
Hey, Crow. I should advise you, I'm going to make it short because we're expecting a call from San Jose on medical marijuana problems they're having over there. But go ahead.
Excellent. Cut me off whenever you need to. I'm just wanting to get Mike Farrell is the one.
Matt Farrell. Right.
Okay, I've heard this name before.
Yeah, Matt is a nice guy who's got some pretty bad ideas, in my view.
Oh, this is a real bad idea. Mm-hmm. Obviously, what you said, you never addressed the question of why people need to get out of their cars in 10 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever, how many minutes it needs to be. It's a good question. And another good one is that not only the union people are behind this for the parking attendants, but it seems like there's a strong backing by people who are trying to protect women or, this seems to, be an outstanding problem with women being attacked in parking lots. Backing this?
Sorry?
Is this true? I mean, this is what I heard on the radio?
Well, there are some. The Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, as far as I know, has not yet come out in favor of this law, though they've expressed concerns about the safety of women in Santa Cruz, and they referred it to two committees. I'm not sure where it's gone. Make your point if you can and roll, because I'm going to try to open up the phone line.
Okay. Yeah, I just feel like we're beating a horse that is not even alive or dead. It never existed, but we're going to beat it anyway.
Let me ask you to bring your saddle down to, about the Saturday demonstration at 3 o'clock in front of Artisans, right?
I'm going to try.
See if you can make it, because I know you got some plots yourself to do some protesting, right?
Every time I'm in my car sitting alone, I'm plotting all the time. Whether it's for 15 minutes or less, I'm plotting.
Well, make sure you have your... And everybody better have a stopwatch with them after June 9th, I'll tell you.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, in the studio with me is Ray Glock-Grunijk, who's a hard man to catch.
Actually, the reason I'm trying to slip and slide in the most elusive manner from your parking ordinance thing is that I wanted to go back and make some further commentary on the Jones decision. And I know that you're going to be having a flood of calls with all the interest on other things coming in over the next hour. So I thought I would try taking advantage of...
Why don't we give you that opening to talk about the Jones decision, and then perhaps once you've done that, you might feel more comfortable making more comments about if they seem relevant to the parking lot matter.
But I do register my opposition to the parking lot ordinance.
You have, indeed. I'm opposed to it, too. I'm looking for... trying to look at different angles, trying to fairly assess evidence that might indicate there's there are some arguments in favor of laws. If there's a high crime area and you can't police it, I guess you could declare it a public nuisance and wall it off. That's one solution, right? I'll ask you whether that's ever a good solution after you finish your analysis of the Jones case. Let's turn to that now, even though we may be interrupted by a phone call from San Jose or by phone calls from listeners. The Jones case, I'm reminding people, is the Los Angeles case decided by the Ninth Circuit Court on April 14th that essentially said to a group of homeless people in Los Angeles, the police cannot stop you from sleeping in the Skid Row area 50 blocks or more or less.
Well, I'm reading your shirt. It says how to use the F word, so I've got to start off with something frivolous.
Yes.
Well, being the
fuck
upward,
off, Ray. That's all I can say here.
Okay. First of all, I've got a mea culpa for my last appearance, actually two programs ago, where I kept talking about Justice Donald Kennedy, and you were correcting me. Actually, there's a Donald Kennedy on the bench in Shasta County Superior Court.
Actually it was John Kennedy you were thinking of.
No, but it is Anthony M. Kennedy, and you were the legal expert. And it just goes to show you I'm not exactly on speaking terms with all of the Supreme Court justices. But you'd also made the comment, which I want to do a little follow-up on, that in some emails to me, some of our listeners found our discussion confusing and that it needed a little translation. And so I was going to translate a couple of the ideas that we'd been talking about, if we had time for that, on the Jones case. And then in addition to that, I wanted to address the issue of, if there's time, of, what's the use of trying to get some action on the Jones case now if, in a matter of a year or so, it's going to be superseded by other decisions of higher rank anyway, either favorable or unfavorable. And I have some commentary on why I believe we should be starting to try exploiting Jones immediately.
Well, the basic issue that I've been kind of kicking around that we've been discussing at the Huff meetings and perhaps human rights organization meeting, we actually had a special meeting last night on the Jones case to talk about it and possible protests downtown, is that Don Zimmerman of the ACLU, who was one of the made a rare appearance at the downtown commission, rare for the ACLU. He wasn't really there as an official representative, but he was an interested ACLU member who took the issue of the parking lot trespass law to them and also took an interest in the Jones decision. And his interpretation of what we need to do, and I think we talked about this a little, Ray, is considerably different than yours. He felt that the Jones decision, which was a 2-1 decision, which was very limited, it didn't declare any law unconstitutional around sleeping. It just declared that a particular police practice you can't arrest people for sleeping. What is it, between 9:30 and 6, or is it between 9 and 6:30 in the Los Angeles Skid Row area? A very limited area, but a significantly large area where homeless people sleep, because if there is no shelter available. And since there isn't any shelter available significantly, as there also isn't in Santa Cruz or most major cities for most people who are homeless, that seemed to be a good opening for Santa Cruz, because we have a situation here where there's no sleeping anywhere between the hours of 11 and 8:30 at night by city law, and that therefore that would be that's a fertile ground to go to and say, look, let's ask the police to designate, let's ask for certain areas to be designated where people can sleep legally. I know that David Silva and others, I was one among them, circulated two initiatives, which made the ballot, to set up areas where people could legally sleep, which were essentially non-residential, non-beachfront areas. And that included about 40% of the town. And the theory behind this initiative was, once this initiative passed, the city council would be obliged to take action to set up more limited zones that would be realistic and actually campground areas. But until then, there would be at least a places where it would be legal for people to be. So the question I brought to Don, and I brought to you, and I'm bringing to other people, is why not try to get an immediate injunction on this issue for enjoining the police from going after any homeless people until there's a shelter bed available in certain limited zones in Santa Cruz. Don's response was, it's risky to do that because you might get a negative decision from the district court in San Jose, and that would then overrule the Jones decision throughout our district court, because the Jones decision is, I don't know, is the Jones decision being appealed? If it's being appealed, of course, if it isn't being appealed, it would overrule the Jones decision, and that kind of decision could be made. A district court judge could say, well, because of the fact that the hours, there are hours where you can sleep in Santa Cruz, most of the time, in fact, majority of the hours of the day, between 8:30 in the morning and 11 o'clock at night, it's perfectly legal to sleep in Santa Cruz. So therefore, there is a window which Judge Kelly, for example, our local jurist, found as a basis
for... Now retired.
Now retired, really. That's new to me. Interesting. I used to call him Kangaroo Kelly, but he hopped out of office, I guess. Nice guy, but again, there are a lot of nice guys around who give horrible decisions. Zimmerman's point was that it's much better to build a slow strategy based, let's say, on what Justice Thurgood Marshall did when he was actually, before he was justice, when he was an NAACP lawyer. He realized you had to slowly expand civil rights, which might take years to play out. And then therefore we should wait
decades
to play out. And therefore we should wait until the whole Ninth Circuit rehears this case, which it probably will be asked to do by Los Angeles officials, and then consider taking an injunction against the sleeping ban. Once they rule in our favor, that's a stronger precedent, rather than risk going to tomorrow going in with to a San Jose judge, a federal judge, and saying, you know, district court has ruled in L.A. in this way. You're bound by this precedent. Stop arresting people in Santa Cruz, and we want it now. What's your response to that?
Okay. I'm actually in between your position and the Zimmerman position of you.
If I'm putting it properly, and I apologize to Don if I've got it wrong.
Right. And I'm going to, you know, I'm not talking about Zimmerman himself. I'm talking about your description of Zimmerman. If there's a difference, then my apologies to him as well.
I would call it the prudent delay position. How
right.
That?
First of all, in my political judgment, I can't say legal judgment because that wouldn't be fair. In my political judgment, the current Jones decision is as good as we are going to get from the courts. So it is not like the situation of the civil rights Thurgood Marshall strategy that you had. And let me just review that strategy a little bit, because it's a different situation. In what you had, you start off with an 1896 decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, that said it's okay to racially segregate as long as you have separate but equal. And so what the initial NAACP strategy was is to say, wait a second, we'd ultimately like to get rid of separation, but we've got a whole lot of separate and very, very, very unequal situations. And so what they started doing was to litigating some of the most egregiously unequal separate facilities and to litigate on the issue of their equality. And only after they had enough political inertia along those lines, which took decades, they started having their first victories in the 1930s. It took them two victories before they got the major victory of Brown versus Board of Education. And even then, it's taken decades longer for enforcement. And, of course, with the current Supreme Court, we have lots of retrenchment.
For those who don't know, we're talking about segregation and the rights of blacks being treated as second-class citizens by using segregation laws in the South. Brown versus Board of Education found that you couldn't have separate but equal schools, for example. Separate but equal was intrinsically unequal, and that was in 1954.
So, for example, what they did, I mean, in the early stages said, they take states like Missouri that had zero law schools for blacks. They said if any black wants to go to law school, we'll help them with their tuition if they go to another state. And they said that is not exactly equal to the highly subsidized law schools that they had for whites. And it went on from there. By contrast, we've just been handed on a platter through the excellent work of some attorneys down south a law case that is as good as we're going to get in from the courts on this issue. I'm not saying it's nearly good enough in terms of human rights, but I think the rest of the struggle is going to have to be political struggle and legislative struggle, not judicial struggle. If we can get Jones actually implemented across the nation, we will have accomplished a huge amount of benefit from what we have presently. So then the question is, what's the best way to implement Jones? I do not think that the best way is to go for an immediate injunction. However, I do think the best way is to immediately file a case for injunction with the goal of seeking a preliminary injunction in a few months, which is different from let's wait until the Ninth Circuit en banc panel comes down, until the U.S. Supreme Court panel comes down. It'll be a year or two. And the difference is,
Zimmerman thinks it'll be 4 months.
I disagree with him.
Mm-hmm.
Just the briefing schedule will take longer than that on the en banc. And then you've got the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court will be a year and a half. My point, what I'm most worried about is rushing into court with a poorly prepared case.
I think that's also his concern, too.
Yeah, and so I think we're confounding the thing of poorly prepared case versus what if we get a judge who doesn't like us and goes ahead and tries to trim back Jones. Those are two separate problems. The first thing we need to do is make sure not to fall on our own swords by poorly preparing our case, because we can assume that even before a friendly judge, the cities are going to spend a lot of resources, resources they might otherwise use to help the poor. They're going to spend a lot of resources to try defending laws that persecute the poor, because that's always been the priority of cities, and Santa Cruz included. So we have to prepare our case carefully. We have to gather our evidence carefully. We have to prepare our witnesses. We have to gather our statistics, and that's going to take several months to put it together in a credible evidentiary state, at least a couple months. And it takes a lot of bucks, and that takes fundraising. And that needs to be done in city after city after city, and we need to start in Santa Cruz because here's where we are. Now, what about the idea of a San Jose federal judge? And I started to give you the wrong answer last time. I started off on the thing of focusing on which judges we have. We have a couple of judges up there that are relatively liberal, people like Judge Fogel, people like Judge Ware. And we have other judges that are perhaps not so liberal, like Judge White, etc. But in one sense, it doesn't matter whether we draw a good judge or a bad judge. It matters on the immediate case and how long things pan out. But a district court judge does not have the right or the authority to overrule the Ninth Circuit. So, and furthermore, a district court judge opinion is not binding on other district court judges. It's not like it applies to the whole thing. It's given some deference. Whereas the Ninth Circuit opinion is binding.
But Zimmerman was, I think, the opinion of another opinion was, I'm going to try to avoid using Don's name because he hasn't authorized me to use it. But, I mean, I don't think he's ashamed of what he had to say. I don't think he would ignore it or deny it. But let's just say this position that he presented was that
Let me go ahead and put some strength in this position. The Santa Cruz circumstance is not on all fours with the Jones case. There are grounds of distinguishment. And a judge in San Jose, a federal judge in San Jose, might very well take advantage of that. I mean, one example is that we do not have a misdemeanor on the first offense. It's an infraction. I don't think that matters, but a judge could say it does matter. Another even more important difference is that we do not have a round-the-clock ban. We only have a nighttime ban. That's a harder issue to deal with. A judge might be friendly to that difference, or he might be unfriendly to that difference. Let's assume for the moment that we get a bad decision on that issue.
And that was his concern, that a bad decision, in spite of the Ninth Circuit, would still be binding on our district. That was his...
No, it's not binding. It's not binding. We could lose our case, and San Jose could go ahead and do a different case and with a different federal judge, and they would not be bound at all by our precedent.
So you disagree with that? Okay.
Yeah. It's only when you get to the appellate level that it's binding, not the trial level. It can influence judges. District court judges do pay a lot of attention and give deference to each other's decision, but they are not bound by it. And they can come up with disparate opinions within the same district, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Now, but the problem is a more basic issue of logic. I think you've got a call. I'll interrupt my analysis and we'll go. Well,
logic will return in a moment. First, however, this. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Ray and Robert.
Hi, this is Bob Patton. I was just calling in. Didn't want to stop your Ray's...
The elusive Bob Patton.
Pardon me?
The elusive Bob Patton.
Well, I was there. Everybody was late, but I don't want to do dirty laundry, so I left.
We're going to fight it out on the air. Go ahead, Bob. What have you got for us tonight?
So I went ahead and called Tulin Ostdigger. She's been asking me to call her this week.
Okay, tell the audience who Tulin is.
Tulin Ostdigger is a she's with the legal staff at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty in Washington, D.C. We, the Human Rights Organization, and Huff start talking with her and Michael Stoops of the Coalition on Homelessness, also in Washington, D.C. And they weighed in around the Lots and Garages law. And however, at the same time, I was sending them all the laws we have that are the sleeping ban, camping ban, begging ban, et cetera, to show them the situation that existed here. So in, with that in mind, we've had communications since early January with this, you know, the NLCHP, National Law Center, I like to call it. She reported to me that she's been in contact with both the city attorneys and the attorneys that have been fighting the Jones case, or fought the Jones case in L.A., that the mayor there is not for sending it forward to an appeal, nor are at least two or three of the city council people. The council is split. However, the district attorney and the police department want to move forward on it. Naturally, they're hoping that it will not go to en banc and that the law will basically remain.
Hang on, Bob. Oh, sure. Let me ask you. I mean, if I understand it, you're saying that, that this attorney from Washington found by talking to the L.A. folks that there's a split as to whether to appeal this or not.
Yes. Most of the city council and the mayor do not want it to go any further. They want it to just stay. Yeah, they don't do not want to have an appeal or en banc, whatever it's called there.
It's called a rehearing en banc.
Rehearing en banc. Now, does this mean? I mean, does this mean that if the mayor's view prevails, they would then make accommodations for allow homeless people to sleep in the Skid Row area down there?
I don't know that part of it. I didn't think to ask her. She didn't mention it.
What about the deadline for appeal? Do we know when that is?
She seemed to think that the window was fairly wide open there. I know
Ray here knows the window, he says.
Yeah.
Ray has talked about the window.
Ray is here.
Window.
So
your window for requesting a rehearing en banc has already closed by now, so the decision's been made on that one way or the other.
Okay.
But the window for going to the U.S. Supreme Court on a petition for certiorari has not closed, and that's a 90-day window.
Okay, so that's probably still their worry. They're working feverishly on the city council persons to keep that from moving on into the Supreme Court, then I guess would be the next thing.
However, what you're saying is very encouraging because would have been far less expensive of them and to have requested a rehearing en banc than to go for a U.S. Supreme Court decision. So if they have already missed their rehearing deadline, which they may or may not have, I don't know. I did not check before showing up tonight. If they've missed that deadline, then the politics may be in line for them also not getting it together for the U.S. Supreme Court battle, because that's a more formidable battle, and they had a really good chance of prevailing on the rehearing.
Why do you say that, Ray?
Well, excuse me. They had a really good chance of getting an en banc hearing because, and I, by the way, here's my second mea culpa. I gave you wrong figures last time. I said there were 35 on the Ninth Circuit bench, active full-time judges, and there are actually 28. So they need to get 11 votes out of 28, not 11 votes out of 35. But even 11 out of 28, that's less than half that they need to come up with in order to get a rehearing.
That's to have a hearing, but actually to win that, they need a majority of those people.
They need to get a majority of 13, and the 13 would be randomly selected. And we've only seen the votes of two. Remember, the person that supported the majority in the Jones opinion was not an active judge, but a retired judge of a district court visiting on the Ninth Circuit. Hmm. So we've seen one good vote, one bad vote so far out of the 28, and there could be a similar split on the rest of the circuit.
Bob, so continue with your report. Anything more from Tulin Osdiger in Washington?
Well, I did forward her the email from Ray that he did fairly lengthy description of what he had talked about on air prior, and she was quite interested in both his take and Don Zimmerman's take, which I had emailed her a copy of the response from the local ACLU that quoted some of Don Zimmerman's concerns and the direction he wanted to go with it, which I gave you a copy of at the Huff meeting. I don't know if you had time to review it. She seems to lean. I'll back up a little bit. She thought it was really an interesting take that Ray had on the Supreme Court with Kennedy, and she didn't quite share his confidence that the Ninth Circuit Court would be forgiving if it went there, and even less likely that we would get a good hearing if it went to the Supreme Court. So I'm just expressing some of the differences that she had talked about after reading Ray's email.
So for all you listeners out there who are completely lost, these are all legal intricacies of what's happening with this very important Jones decision in L.A. Will it be appealed? Will it be appealed first to this super court of the Ninth Circuit called the en banc hearing, and then to the Supreme Court? Apparently, we don't even know if they've applied for an en banc hearing, because according to you, Ray, that deadline has closed.
That's my understanding.
And according to you, Bob, Tulene Ozdigger of Washington didn't tell you whether they were able to get together to do that en banc appeal?
She did not know. I mean, if the time limit's up and they didn't do it, I guess it's done with.
I mean, I did put a call through to the attorneys who pushed this lawsuit, the ACLU in Los Angeles, yesterday. I got Eric Green.
Mm-hmm.
He did not... apparently did not know what was going on at that point. So he didn't have any information either. So we're a little bit unclear.
Maybe by next Thursday we'll have some news.
Maybe we'll know more by next Thursday. But go ahead, Bob. Anything
well,
more
yeah, one other thing was she was mentioning, because I had focused in on this difference between the Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit when it comes to the cruel and unusual, where you have to have had your cruel and unusual treatment already before you get, you know, your cruel and unusual decision. However, you know, she seems to think that because these men, or at least a couple of these people, the defendants, had received citations on this particular charge, that it also fit into and didn't go against that ruling of Johnson versus whatever it was.
Well, we're getting kind of arcane here. I'm not sure what you're talking about. Even I'm not clear what you're talking about. I don't know if we want to...
That was part of the stuff I was hoping to translate if there's time later on in the program.
Well, maybe we'll skip to your translation, because obviously Robert didn't understand it. I didn't say it very well.
Well, you know, I mean, my interest here is actually a rather simple question that maybe is... I put it out last night at this meeting we had on the Jones decision, which was that... Why not simply have a sleep out downtown and do so in a very visible place where the police can't simply, you know, ignore us? And then when the police come to ticket us being homeless people who actually have a need to sleep and have no shelter, that will document the fact that there is an ongoing police practice of arresting people now or citing people now for illegal sleeping. The documentation will be piling up every time those tickets are written, and then we will use that as the basis for going to court in a subsequent attempt to get an injunction. What's your thought about that, both of you, Bob and Ray? You first, Ray, and then you, Bob.
Well, I quite frankly, there's lots of sloppiness to it in terms of the wiggle, giving the courts ways to wiggle out of it. I have a recommendation that I have a conflict of interest on that I need to report to the listeners for disclosure, because I think there needs to be carefully prepared litigation that takes money, that takes bucks, and as a paralegal, I might be hired on such a litigation, might be paid some of those bucks, so that's my conflict of interest that I need to disclose.
well, I hope you can satisfy that for you.
But I would prefer to see the energy going into fundraising and into political agitation on the thing. I don't think that particular form of political agitation right now helps us to build our evidence. I think that what we have to document is primarily the filled up shelter spaces, not the idea of them citing. Unfortunately, we can get documentation rather easily that they continue to cite because we still have prosecution.
It's also very easy to get documentation in the summer that shelter spaces are full. There is a standard letter they write, which they pass on to anyone who comes in there with a sleeping ticket saying shelter spaces were full last night.
Yeah, and
that's just it.
Oh, okay, so let me go. Well, actually, let me let Bob answer.
Go ahead, Bob.
I did talk to Tulin about that, and she agrees. She thinks that the documentation, for us not to be afraid to move forward on whatever it is that we feel we can do, particularly about getting documentations around plaintiffs, getting plaintiffs lined up, get the release of information from the police department on exactly how many citations, are they arrested, how are they treated, so on and so forth. This is what she mentioned. It kind of goes in line with what Ray is saying. So she's not trying to discourage us from doing anything. Now, on the, she did warn a little bit, though, about, you know, not taking this case if it goes through to the right place and getting the right decision. But she wasn't...
I'm not sure what you're saying, Bob.
Doing stuff locally.
Say that again. It's not clear
what
you
just
said.
She wasn't discouraging us from doing activities, illegal activities. In other words, trying to fight it one way or another in the court, but definitely getting the documentation and putting, getting plaintiffs lined up.
Fair enough.
And she said it wouldn't bother if the case went on somewhere else. With the Jones. And actually, she said it is being used in San Diego right now.
Which is what I found out when I talked to Larry Milligan last night.
And that's on the state camping ban, the one that the guy just yesterday
647J.
Yeah.
That's the state anti-law.